Hello, friends, and welcome to this edition of the Ames Tribune for Monday, December 28th, 2020. Your reader today is Dave Sellerman, and you are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. And here is our first story. 45 new COVID-19 cases reported in Story County over the holiday weekend. No new deaths reported statewide. This story written by Daniel Gare. Another 45 new cases were confirmed in Story County after the holiday weekend, the state's coronavirus website showed at 10 a.m. on Monday. At that time, state officials reported 7,870 positive cases in Story County, up from Thursday's total of 7,825. To date, a total of 29 Story County residents have died as a result of COVID-19, according to Iowa's coronavirus website. After the state adopted a new way of calculating the number of people who died from COVID-19 on the evening of December 7th, Story County's pandemic death toll dropped from 25 on December 7th to 18 on December 8th. COVID-19 is the respiratory disease caused by coronavirus. Of those who have tested positive for the virus in Story County, 6,880 individuals have recovered, according to the state. As of Monday, Story County's 14-day average positivity rate is 8%, down from 9% last week. To date, a total of 45,382 Story County residents have been tested for the virus. As of 10 a.m. on Monday, the state was reporting no new COVID-19-related deaths statewide since 10 a.m. on Sunday. COVID-19 deaths can take up to a week to be reported on the state's website. There are 275,471 confirmed cases of coronavirus in Iowa, an increase of 538 that the state was reporting at 10 a.m. on Monday. The total number of people tested is 1,342,810. Of the people who have tested positive, 229,626 have recovered. Next story, winter storm likely to arrive Tuesday into Wednesday, and it could make driving conditions dangerous. Between the two holidays, Iowans may have to adjust their travel plans this week. The National Weather Service issued a winter storm warning for much of central Iowa Monday morning in advance of a storm expected to create hazardous travel conditions across the state on Tuesday and into early on Wednesday. Central Iowa has the highest potential for moderate to heavy snow, according to the National Weather Service, with higher chances of light freezing rain or a wintry mix throughout the state in southern Iowa. The storm's uncertain track and temperature conditions have left the type of precipitation and expected total still in doubt. Across central Iowa, generally from Atlantic through Des Moines over to Cedar Rapids and Dubuque, that's kind of the axis right now for the heaviest snowfall, according to Roger Vachalek, a National Weather Service meteorologist. East of Atlantic, we're looking at 5 to 8 inches of snow, and east of Des Moines, maybe 5 to 8 inches. Along Interstate 80, there is some potential for snow and some freezing rain or sleet on Tuesday. Central Iowa will experience the worst part of the storm starting at 4 p.m. Tuesday until 2 a.m. on Wednesday morning. Widespread travel hazards and impacts are likely before precipitation ends on Wednesday, warns the National Weather Service. The heavy wet snow may also produce broken tree branches and possible power outages. We could be looking at some rather heavy snowfall rates here of 1 inch per hour at times, so that will make tomorrow's evening commute rather difficult, said Vachalek. The wet heavy snow is very slippery, and that could cause more crashes, and people need to be aware. Well, that covers the electronic stories up to date on the Ames Tribune's website. Now we'll turn to the printed version of the Tribune. This story comes to us from the Associated Press. No officers convicted by Iowa Attorney General in force cases since 2004. When police pulled over Marquise Jones for loud music one sunny afternoon in October 2017, the 27-year-old black man got out of his car and he ran. Jones escaped one officer's tackle and carried a handgun as he fled through a neighborhood in Burlington. That's in Iowa. Police yelled for him to drop his weapon before Officer Chris Chiprez fired 7 times, missing Jones. Jones ditched the gun, ran down an alley and into a backyard, and laid on the ground as Chiprez pursued. Chiprez said he shot and killed Jones after he started to rise and made a hand movement. Relatives say Jones, a father of five, was trying to surrender. To determine whether Chipperez should face charges, authorities turned to Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller, a Democrat and the longest-serving attorney general in United States history, with four decades in that role. Like more than 30 other cases involving force used by police since 2004, Miller's office soon cleared Chipperez of wrongdoing, according to documents obtained by the Associated Press through an open records request. A state prosecutor concluded Chipperez had a reasonable belief that Jones was armed and dangerous when he fired the fatal shot. He rejected claims that the officer knew Jones had dropped his gun, which was later found about 50 yards from his body. Police officers are not often charged when suspects end up injured or dead. Laws give them the benefit of the doubt for a dangerous and unpredictable job, and juries are reluctant to convict. But prosecutors who have histories of declining to charge police are facing more scrutiny of their records, particularly following a summer of mass protests calling for accountability. That dynamic has emerged in Iowa, where lawmakers in June gave Miller new power to investigate such deaths, even as some of his office's previous rulings backing the police have disappointed families and civil rights lawyers. The Associated Press found that Miller's office has not convicted an officer for improperly using force in at least 16 years, the earliest date for which reports were available. It pursued charges against two officers out of 35 force cases reviewed, and both were ultimately acquitted. The Attorney General's office closed 31 other cases after determining the officers' actions were justified and sent two other cases to grand juries that did not return indictments. Linn County Supervisor Stacy Walker, a leading voice for racial justice in Iowa, said the Associated Press's findings demonstrate that the criminal justice system is not only racially biased, but catastrophically broken. He said it was time for a new generation of prosecutors who are more reform-minded. When police officers kill innocent people and face no consequences, or avoid prosecution altogether, it encourages bad behavior and further corrupts our criminal legal system. This has to change, Walker said. Miller said Iowa averages about six deaths by police each year, including one of a person of color. He said experienced prosecutors make charging decisions based on the facts and the law in each case, and that he is comfortable with the results. He said the lack of convictions does not indicate bias toward police, noting that four cases were pursued through charges or grand juries. These were our strongest cases, which indicates in the others we were not missing cases that we should have done, he said. I believe that we did our duty. The incidents included 26 in which one or more officers fired service weapons, killing 15 people and injuring several others. That tally does not represent most force incidents. Until recently, the Attorney General's office could only review them if local prosecutors requested assistance. The Associated Press did not find any instance in which Miller's office reviewed force used by police in Des Moines or Davenport because prosecutors there handle cases themselves. Other counties requested reviews, citing conflicts of interest. In last year's death of 22-year-old Drew Edwards in Maquoketa, Miller's office referred a review request to another county attorney, citing temporary staffing shortages. Officers who sat on Edwards' head and body for 10 minutes until he stopped breathing were cleared, but the city and the county recently agreed to pay $4.5 million to Edwards' family. Some change is coming. A law signed by Governor Kim Reynolds in June in response to racial injustice protests authorizes the Attorney General to investigate any officer's use of force that results in death. Miller pledged to make independent assessments in each case about whether officers committed crimes or other misconduct. Over the past 6 months, his office has cleared police in two deaths and has been reviewing a third, though it has not used its new power to recommend the suspension or the revocation of an officer's certification for misconduct. State Representative Ross Smith, a Democrat from Waterloo, pushed for the charges after the shooting death of his friend Dietrich Ambrose Jr. The 22-year-old black man was fatally shot after running while armed from a Waterloo police officer in 2012 following a disturbance outside a nightclub. Ambrose discarded his handgun while fleeing, and his supporters called for the officer who killed him to be arrested. Then Blackhawk County Attorney Tom Ferguson impaneled a grand jury that did not indict the officer in 2013. Critics argued the proceeding was tainted by a shoddy police investigation and testimony from a controversial force science expert who was routinely hired nationwide to back officers in fatal shootings. The city in 2016 paid $2.5 million to settle a lawsuit brought by Ambrose's father. By then, Ferguson was working in the Attorney General's office as the Director of Training for county prosecutors statewide. Miller said he was unaware of concerns about Ferguson's handling of the Ambrose case when he hired him, but that he was a consensus voice who did exemplary work. Smith said the law would ensure fair outside reviews in such cases, but some are doubtful that the law or public pressure will change outcomes much. I do think that bringing outside agencies to do the investigations in these cases is important, said Bowling Green State University criminal justice professor Philip Stinson. But I am skeptical that we are going to see lasting change. He noted that fewer than 20 officers nationwide are charged in fatal shootings every year, and said investigations are often shaped from the beginning by the assumption that they are justified. David O'Brien, an attorney who represents the Jones family and others whose relatives were killed by police, said he has been disappointed by some of the state's rulings, alleging that they helped hide police misconduct and seemed to look for ways to exonerate officers. This is something that causes me grave concern, O'Brien said. Police officers have a difficult and a dangerous job, but when they screw up, we should not be covering up for them, and that's what we're doing right now. The Attorney General's office is part of the problem and not part of the solution. Miller rejected that criticism as totally wrong. We call them like we see them, without any favor or bias, Miller said. When counties ask Miller's office to review the use of force, the cases have usually landed on the desk of Assistant Attorney General Scott Brown, who leads the division that helps counties prosecute homicides. Records show Brown has exonerated officers in 24 cases in 2014. He cleared an officer who entered a Fort Madison couple's home without a warrant and fatally shot their 27-year-old son, who had been out puncturing tires and was armed with a knife. Months later, Brown found it wasn't excessive for officers to shoot 63 times at an armed Iowa Falls man who was killed after threatening police during a standoff. In 2016, Brown reasoned that a white officer who pulled the hair of a handcuffed black man and hit him in the head after a dangerous high-speed chase should not be charged with assault because jurors would be unlikely to convict under the circumstances. He cleared a Manchester officer who tackled a combative detainee in 2010, saying the officer was trying to control the suspect. His head struck the door frame and he was rendered unconscious, has no bearing on the determination of criminal culpability. The state's prosecution of the two officers who were charged failed. In 2011, a judge found a Muscatine County deputy not guilty of assault for hitting and throwing to the ground a 24-year-old suspect, saying he did not use perfect judgment, but force was justified. In 2005, jurors acquitted a Shelby County deputy of voluntary manslaughter in the shooting of an unarmed motorist following a chase. In Marquise Jones' death, Brown concluded that the man fled because, unbeknownst to the officers, he faced outstanding warrants and illegally possessing a handgun. He said Shiprez had no way of knowing Jones had dropped his weapon, that there was no credible evidence Jones was trying to surrender, and that Jones was a deadly threat even if he was fleeing. Jones's mother claims in a wrongful death lawsuit that her son kept the gun for self-defense and that it fell out of his waistband after he was tackled. The lawsuit argues that Jones never pointed the gun at police and that he dropped the weapon as commanded, but Shiprez shot him wildly nonetheless, then killed him while he was unarmed. A trial is scheduled for March. Next is a story from Rana Faborg. It is titled Gifts to Cherish. Diane Tott was devastated to lose her family's beloved walnut tree when the derecho blew through central Iowa on August 10th. Faced with the reality of losing the tree forever, Tot had an epiphany. She would have some of the walnut lumber made into lefese, I'm going to spell that L-E-F-S-E, rolling pins, and she would give the treasures as gifts for Christmas. The project of turning that walnut into working rolling pins, perfect for making the traditional Norwegian flatbread called lefese, I must be pronouncing that wrong probably, but it's spelled L-E-F-S-E, lefese, maybe, was not an easy task. Perhaps apropos, it became a story that the rich history of the tree merited, Tot said, and the results are usable works of art. As a child, Tot spent innumerable hours playing near the tree on the Roland area farm where she grew up. Tot now lives in Ames and is retired after serving as clerk of court for 31 years. The family farm continues to belong to her mother, Esther Franston. We lived on the farm, and so did my uncle and his family, so I got to grow up there with my cousins. And my grandmother lived there until later in the 1960s, when she moved into Roland, Tot said. It was quite a place with many good memories. Over the years, the tree held a tire swing and a bag swing, and it graced the family with walnuts, which the kids would help harvest. Tot and her family used an antique corn shelter, antique corn sheller, to remove the husks. Then they washed the walnuts and they let them dry, she said. During cold winter nights, my dad often sat and shelled the walnuts, which my mom would later use in her baking, Tot said. Mom and Dad's grandchildren and great-grandchildren have helped with the harvesting. Tot's family connection to the walnut tree inspired her to have it live on through another beloved family tradition, the rolling of lefse. In late August, she contacted Gary Legwold, also known as the Lefse King, a Minneapolis man who has become an expert on the subject of Norwegian flatbread. A writer, editor, and speaker, Legwold also teaches classes on lefse making. He had been a speaker at a Sons of Norway Kongsvinger Lodge event in Story City in October 2017, where he presented the program Lefse, Lutfisk, and the Importance of Humor. Tot had seen Legwold speak at that event, and she reached out to him. Could he help her figure out how to turn part of the fallen tree into the five beautiful rolling pins? Part of Legwold's business is dealing in heirloom lefse rolling pins, which range in price from $125 to $1,200 on his website, lefsing.com. That's spelled L-E-F-S-E-K-I-N-G.com. Legwold has an important connection. Bob Putes, an expert woodturner who could put the walnut blanks on his lathe and work his magic. It's a really cool thing, Legwold said. This tree that was so much a part of Diane's family now is contributing on as five different rolling pins. If you go to the Vesterheim Museum in Decora, you'll see rolling pins there that came over from Norway and are 150 years old. They're like a recipe card. They're just keep on and keep on, picking up sentimental value. There were many helpers along the way to the creation of the rolling pins, Tot said. Tot's cousin Ron Franston lives across the road from the family farm, and he helped with the tree, which wasn't actually toppled by the storm, but it was so severely damaged that it needed to be removed. We also got a lot of help from our tree guy, Rob Morgan, who cut it just the right length and made sure it was the good parts of the tree, Tot said. He tried to count the rings, and it was about 90 years old, or in that ballpark. Tot's grandparents bought the farm in the early 1930s, so it made me wonder, did Grandpa plant that walnut tree, she asked. There were a few hiccups in the process of creating the rolling pins. Diane Tot arranged for the tree trunk to be sawed into 20-inch lengths. Her husband Bob and cousin Ron loaded four logs into Bob's pickup truck and took them to Legwald's house in Minneapolis, where the Lessing King planned to put them in his Prius and haul them to Hastings, Minnesota. But the logs were too big and too heavy for his passenger car to carry. Bob Todd saved the day and offered to drive the logs to Hastings, where they would be cut and then vacuum kiln dried. The kiln drying caused cracks to form in some of the blanks, which put the job in jeopardy. But eventually, Peutz found blanks that he was able to carve on his lathe and expose the beauty within. That's part of the attraction with wood turning, Legwald said. The beauty of the wood only reveals itself once you start turning it and slowly removing wood. Lefse rolling pins have texture, usually either horizontal grooves or a crosshatch pattern. It was important to Tot for these pins to have a crosshatch pattern, since that's the kind she and her family remembers and have always used. She learned to roll Lefse when she was about 10, but for the most part in those years, it was the matriarchs of the family, the grandmothers and the mothers, who made the dish. Legwald explained that the texture on the pins helps decrease the amount of flour that is forced into the flatbread. Too much flour makes the lefse tough, he said. His own first attempts at making the Norwegian delicacy turned out like lefse jerky, because he didn't know about the impact of the flour. We got it done, and they are beautiful, he said, of the rolling pins. I call them functional pieces of art. The rolling pins have food-safe ball bearings and a steel rod to give them strength and smooth rolling ability. When I first saw them, I asked, are these just to be displayed? But Gary said, no, these are definitely to be used, Tot said. So we will definitely be rolling Lefse with them. They're substantial and they are beautiful. The grain of the wood and the colors, Legwald said, they speak for themselves. But then you put the traditional grooves in it and put a light finish on it, of mineral oil or walnut oil. It really pops and brings out the beauty of the wood. Then, they're not in use, the rolling pins will likely be displayed on special stands, honoring them as the artwork that they are, like Walt said. Tot is keeping one of the rolling pins and gave the others to her two sisters and two daughters for Christmas gifts. They will put them to good use, making Lefse for friends and family, she said. The wood's source from the walnut tree would have meaning for the recipients as well. Stories about both Lefse and walnuts have threaded their way through Tot's family history, as she and both of her sisters have incorporated Lefse traditions into their holidays. And they all have memories of harvesting walnuts, an activity they don't always love while they were in the act of it, but now all share a valuable, cherished memory surrounding that tree and its fruits. Tom's mother is Dutch and her dad was Norwegian, but my mom really embraced the Norwegian heritage and the Lefse rolling. Lefse has been a big part of our family Christmas tradition, she said. Our Lefse is traditionally served with cod, riced potatoes, just the right amount of salt and pepper, and a hard-boiled egg and butter mixture. Tot and her family remembers, roll up the Lefse and hold it in both hands while eating it. It just doesn't taste right if you have to eat it with a fork. You were listening to the Ames Tribune on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Your reader today is Dave Sauerman, and it is time for us to turn to the obituaries. Louise Gail Onken, age 50, of Boone, passed away at home on Monday, December 21st. She was born on February 26, 1970, in Ames, the daughter of Norm Lyon and Judy Briggy Donato. Louise graduated from Ballard High School in 1988 and then attended Iowa State University. She worked at Helping Hands Veterinary Clinic in Boone as a veterinary assistant, where she was able to show her love for animals, especially cats. Louise was a member of the Civic Center, where she enjoyed going to musicals. She loved music, attending live concerts, and also loved movies, especially Disney movies. Traveling was something that Louise enjoyed. She loved going to her nieces and nephews' activities and loved watching them grow into young adults. Louise was a very loving person who was always willing to help with whatever was needed. She trusted in God's plan for her, and it was time for her to be rewarded for remaining faithful to it. Louise was preceded in death by her father, Norm Lyon, and both sets of grandparents. Survivors include her mother, Judy, and Jim Donato of Ames, stepmother Becky Lyon Aspergren of Boone, sister Lynette Peterson of Jefferson, and stepsister Melissa Jacobson of Riverside, nieces and nephews Hannah, Victoria and Chance Peterson of Jefferson, Emily Gray of Sloan, Nathan and Carrie Jacobson of Riverside, Aunts Edie and Rod Samuelson of Johnston, and Joan and Dick Sargent of Fountain Hills, Arizona. In lieu of flowers, memorials are suggested to the Boone Area Humane Society. Due to COVID-19, a private family graveside service will be held at the Ames Municipal Cemetery. Online condolences may be left at schroederfuneral.com. You can call the funeral home at Schroeder-Dark-Wallen Funeral Home, 515-432-4550. Our next obituary, Dennis E. Page, age 78, of Frederick, Maryland, passed from this life on Monday, December 21st, at Glade Valley Nursing Home in Walkersville, Maryland. Dennis was born on September 8th, 1942. He was the son of Edwin Polzwak and Marie McKinney. He is survived by his wife, Sandy, of 52 years. He was survived by his son, Andrew, daughter-in-law, Beth, and grandchildren, Lucy and Peter. He's also survived by his daughter, Deborah Dodson, son-in-law, David Dodson, and grandchildren, Lucas and Zachary. His son, Peter, passed away in 1987 at the age of 16. Dennis was an active church member who believed in the Lord Jesus Christ as his Savior. He enjoyed reading and fishing. Dennis had a long career as a microbiologist. The family will hold a small funeral gathering soon, and a memorial service once the COVID-19 virus is no longer a risk. Memorial donations may be made to Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, 1415 West 7th Street, Frederick, Maryland, 21702. Expressions of sympathy may be offered to the family at stauferfuneralhome.com. That's spelled S-T-A-U-F-F-E-R, funeralhome.com. Our next story, Madrid's Greater Love Ministries offers a lifeline of food and clothing. This story by Sarah Jordan Heinz. Greater Love Ministries Food Pantry and Clothing Thrift Store is a resource for those in the community experiencing food insecurity and financial hardship. It is located at 613 West North Street in Madrid, in a building on the same property as the Madrid Home Communities. The organization's director, Dave Thompson, said he and a group of approximately 12 dedicated volunteers operate the nonprofit organization. Food is mainly sourced from the Food Bank of Iowa. We can buy food for 14 cents a pound, he said, so it makes it much easier to make sure our shelves are full. Around 175,000 Iowans struggle with hunger in the 55 counties that the Food Bank of Iowa serves. It moves 1.2 million pounds of food each month through its distribution center, which then gets sent off to partner agencies. Last year, it distributed nearly 14 million meals, according to the Food Bank of Iowa's website. Both perishable and non-perishable goods are offered at Greater Love Ministries, and it is the only place of its kind in Madrid. Local schools, churches, and the United States Postal Service also help collect food items. There are no income requirements for food assistance during the COVID-19 pandemic. Registering for services can be done in the same day that you pick up your items. Proof of residency and an identification are required. The organization serves a 6-mile radius of Madrid. We're not going to turn people away, but we're a small organization and cannot serve the entire county, he said. Clothing items are available for all ages and all sizes. Many pieces still have the tags on them. Extra clothing gets sent to area charitable organizations for both low-income people and veterans in need. Greater Love Ministries Food Pantry and Clothing Thrift Store is open on Tuesdays and Wednesdays from 9 to 10 a.m. and from 4 to 5:30 p.m., as well as the first Saturday of every month from 9 a.m. to 12 noon. Its main objectives speak of its religious roots. The mission of the Greater Love Ministries, with the help of the community, is to fulfill a command of Jesus Christ with loving care for those in need, specifically to provide food and clothing to families and individuals of the Madrid community who are experiencing financial stress. Thompson said those in need of immediate food assistance can call and leave a message He will then return the call and set up a time for an appointment for you to stop or shop. Thompson and his late wife, Jackie, were the heart and the soul of the organization for more than a decade. My wife passed away in July of this year. She pretty much was the leadership part of the clothing store. Other people have really stepped forward and helped with that, he noted. Thompson said the holiday season has brought with it an increase in people coming in for service. We've registered some new families just in the last month. That need is there, but getting the word out about us is the hard part, he said. Greater Love Ministries may be reached at the following telephone number, and if they do not answer, you can leave a message. That telephone number is 515-795-3913. And that phone number, once again, is 515-795-3913. Here's the Dennis the Menace comic for today. Apparently, Dennis must have asked Santa for a sled with dogs to go with it. You know, kind of like up in Alaska where they have dog sleds where 8 or 10 dogs are pulling sleds. Dennis must have asked Santa for one of those. Anyway, he's on his sled, and Tommy, his buddy, is trying to push him. And Dennis is looking back at Tommy behind him, who's pushing him on the sled. And Dennis says, Santa brought the sled, but the dogs never showed up. And here's the real-life comic for today. Husband says to his wife, I'm off to the store. Which bottled water do you want me to get? And she says, the one with the most Chardonnay in it. Next is an Associated Press story. The dateline is Brussels. The EU and the UK unveil a big trade accord. The European Union and the United Kingdom made public Saturday the vast agreement that is likely to govern future trade and cooperation between them starting on Friday, setting the 27-nation bloc's relations with its former member and neighbor on a new but far more distant footing. EU ambassadors and lawmakers on both sides of the English Channel are studying the EU-UK Trade and Cooperation Agreement, which contains over 1,200 pages of text. EU envoys were expected to meet Monday to discuss the document, drawn up over 9 intense months of talks. Businesses, so long left in the dark about what is in store for them, also will be trying to understand its implications. Most important, the deal as it stands ensures that Britain can continue to trade in goods with the world's biggest trading bloc, without tariffs or quotas, after the UK breaks fully free of the European Union. European Union member countries are expected to endorse the agreement over the course of the week. British legislators could vote on it Wednesday. But European Union lawmakers said last weekend that there simply was not enough time to scrutinize the text properly before the deadline, and they will debate and vote on the document in January and February. Next is a story from the Globe Gazette in Mason City. Shanane Simmers is a senior at Mason City Alternative High School, and for much of the past couple of weeks, she's been a little more excited than usual to go to school. Simmers and her classmates have been busy working on buddy blankets to deliver to the elementary schools in the Mason City Community School District, just in time for the holidays. Buddy Blankets is a project the alternative school has participated in for a number of years. Teachers and administrators at each of the 4 elementary schools in the district pick 3 students in their building who might need a blanket, and students at the alternative school make them. I think that these kids deserve a little special present, so that's what we make, Simmers told the Mason City Globe Gazette. This year, some students who made the blankets will deliver the blankets directly to the elementary school students. I'm just so excited to see their little faces, Simmers said. Just being able to have them light up and get so excited to be happy about something that I made for them is so exciting. I am an artist, and I like making stuff for people. When I get to see people like things that I make, it makes me so happy. The blankets are made with 2 3-by-4-foot squares of fleece that are put on top of each other, cut every couple of inches around the sides, and then tied together. Stephanie Walters, a teacher at the alternative school, says that she hopes that in the process of making these blankets and giving them away, the kids can take a life lesson out of it. Some of our kids really get into it. It makes them feel good that they can do something for somebody else because a lot of these kids don't have very much stuff, Walker said. They get to feel like they can give that back. For three students at each of Hoover, Jefferson, Harding, and Roosevelt elementary schools, the cold winter season will be a little bit warmer this year. Even though making small blankets is a small gesture, it is not lost among the students and the staff how important something like that could be for them. It's nice to do something for someone else and to know that this is going to be a nice gift for somebody, Junior Kaya Torres said. It could mean a lot to a kid, and that's what I always think. It's a small thing, like this is just a blanket, but some kids need blankets. This project is a good reminder that school doesn't always have to be about books and grades. To see students get excited about giving back is a heartwarming experience, according to Waters. The kids can actually like doing something, Waters said. This is kind of a good end to this crazy year. Next is a story from the Seattle Times. Boeing speeds up 787 consolidation in South Carolina. Boeing will speed up the consolidation of 787 production in South Carolina so that Everett, Washington will lose final assembly of the airplane by March rather than the originally announced timeline of mid-2021, according to an internal company memo. The memo to all 787 employees was sent by Lane Ballard, Boeing Vice President and General Manager of the 787 program, and the site leader at the North Charleston, South Carolina manufacturing site. Production and delivery consolidation in South Carolina will take place in March 2021, Ballard wrote. The company's reduction of the 787 production rate from 6 airplanes a month to 5 will also be implemented by then, he said. Ballard's memo states that 787 employees in Everett will continue to work after the March transfer of final assembly, inspecting the already completed 787s for the quality defects that have been discovered at the fuselage join and performing any needed repairs. I know you will have many questions. Chief among them may be, what will be the impact to employment? We are working through details, Ballard told the employees. There is no plan to shift teammates from Everett to South Carolina or vice versa, the memo states, adding that the work to inspect the fuselage joints will likely extend 787 work in Everett beyond the production consolidation plan. Boeing spokesperson Jessica Koval said about 1,000 people work directly on the 787 program in the Puget Sound region. Boeing in August grounded 8 787s after discovering quality defects at the join of the aft fuselage. Last month, it expanded the scope of its inspections to include all the joints in all of the fuselage sections, which are manufactured in Wichita, Kansas, and in Italy and Japan, as well as in South Carolina. The examinations of already completed planes has led to a logjam of parked and undelivered 787 jets, which Boeing says it will take most of next year to clear. Boeing is setting up what it calls join verification stations in Everett and North Charleston, where the work of inspecting and repairing the 787 fuselage joins will be done. Next is a story from the Associated Press. The dateline is Madison, Wisconsin. New Wisconsin GOP head wants earlier ballot counting. The incoming Republican majority leader in the Wisconsin Senate wants to pass a bill early in 2021 to change state law to allow for the counting of absentee ballots before Election Day, a change that he tried to get passed with Democratic support last year, but never got a vote in the legislature. Senator Devin Lemieux, in an interview on Thursday with the Associated Press, said allowing for earlier counting of ballots is one of his priorities as the legislature looks to make changes to how elections in the battleground state are run. There is a push among Republicans to make changes in the wake of President Donald Trump's unfounded claims of widespread fraud that were rejected by state and federal courts. Trump lost Wisconsin by nearly 21,000 votes. Lemieux admitted he had no idea if fellow Republicans who will control the Senate 20-12 would go along with allowing for earlier absentee voting. I have no idea where my caucus would be on that, but I would think it would pass, Lemelu said, as long as it is secure. I would think we could get there. It would also have to pass the GOP-controlled assembly, which last year supported a more limited bill that would only allow for people voting in person early to feed their ballots into counting machines. Mailed-in ballots, of which there were nearly 1.3 million this year, would not be counted early. Anything the legislature passes has to be signed by Democratic Governor Tony Evers to become law, making it unlikely that widespread election changes would occur. But Evers and Democrats have been supportive of allowing local elections officials to begin counting absentee ballots earlier than on Election Day. Current law prohibits any ballots to be counted before the polls open at 7 o'clock in the morning. With nearly 2 million ballots cast, that's absentee ballots in Wisconsin, that resulted in results in some counties not being reported until later than usual on election night in Milwaukee and Green Bay, where all ballots are counted at a central location. State law forbids reporting partial results. That led to totals in those counties, which heavily favored Biden, not being announced until between 2 a.m. and 4 a.m. Following Election Day. That fueled rumors and false accusations on social media and by President Trump. Our next story comes to us from the Tribune News Service. Why Austin, Texas is winning the battle for tech firms. Civil War General Philip Sheridan famously said, "If I owned Texas and hell, I would rent out Texas and live in hell." The situation has obviously changed. Not only is Dallas a major corporate center and Houston, the nation's fourth most populous city, the capital of the oil industry, but Austin is a rising tech star. Austin's ascendancy was emphasized recently when software powerhouse Oracle said it would move its headquarters there from Silicon Valley. In truth, the reality is more nuanced and the threat to Silicon Valley is minimal. The same can be said for Seattle. After losing Boeing's headquarters to Chicago in 2001, Seattle went on a nearly unprecedented boom, especially in the 2010s. But unpacking what's driving Austin's popularity and the implications for Seattle's status as a major technical capital is still rewarding. Oracle's roots in Silicon Valley go back to the early years of the transformation of the agricultural valley of Heart's Delight to its present name. The company was founded in 1977 as Software Development Laboratories. In Texas this month, the boosters immediately went to work. The local newspaper trumpeted an economist calling Oracle a huge development for Austin's future. It follows the recruitment of Apple and Tesla and other companies that are really going to guarantee Austin a decade of significant growth, the likes of which we've never seen before. Texas Governor Greg Abbott predictably said, while some states are driving away businesses with high taxes and heavy-handed regulation, we continue to see a tidal wave of companies like Oracle moving to Texas, thanks to our friendly business climate, low taxes, and the best workforce in the nation. Hewlett-Packard Enterprise Company recently announced a move of its headquarters to Houston as well, and Elon Musk, a longtime critic of California, moved to Texas. So have 687,000 other Californians over the last decade. Austin has evolved over the decades from a sleepy capital city, albeit with a Capitol dome, Texans will remind you, that rises higher than the one in Washington, D.C. It boasts a leading music scene with the South by Southwest Festival, decent Tex-Mex cuisine, and the flagship campus of the University of Texas. Austin is more progressive, edgier, and tolerant than most of the Lone Star State. Put it all together, and Austin was well positioned to develop as a tech hub. Oracle already has a campus there. You'll find similar outposts of big tech, including Apple, which announced in 2019 plans to build a $1 billion campus there. That site is prepared to handle 5,000 employees initially, with capacity to grow to 15,000. Apple already has about 7,000 employees in Austin. Amazon, too, has an Austin software development office. Lower housing costs are undeniable. one result of a generally flat topography and minimal land use protections that make it amiable to sprawl. But Austin also has downsides. Traffic is miserable, and it is surprisingly behind on mass transit, only this year approving a light rail system, while Dallas boasts the longest in the nation. Oracle's campus is entirely car-dependent. The nearest bus stop is several blocks away. The weather is blazing hot in the summer. Austin lacks the high-end cultural amenities paid for with oil money in Dallas and Houston. State law blocks localities from acquiring low-income units in apartment buildings, a plus for developers, but not for the poor. Texas also struggles with inadequately funded schools, especially in poor districts, high poverty rates, and outsized environmental problems. The state leads the nation in greenhouse gas emissions. Our next story comes to us from the Associated Press. The dateline is Beijing, China. China signals a shift, but no let-up in Xinjiang. An official from China's Communist Party signaled Monday that there would likely be no let-up in its crackdown in the remote Xinjiang region, but said the government's focus is shifting more to addressing the roots of extremism. China's policies in Xinjiang, home to the Uyghurs and other predominantly Muslim ethnic groups, have become a major point of division with the United States and other Western nations over alleged human rights violations. We cannot be complacent at this moment because the threats are still out there. Jing Guangxiang, the deputy director general of the Xinjiang Communist Party publicity department, said in an interview with the Associated Press in Beijing. Analysts say China has detained more than 1 million people in Xinjiang, forcing many to give up at least elements of their faith and traditions. Activists accuse China of mass detentions, forced labor, forced birth control, and wiping out the Uyghur, pronounced Uyghur, language and culture. Chinese officials deny the accusations and tout what they say has been a successful effort to de-radicalize the population and provide job training, saying the region hasn't had a terrorist attack in 4 years. Zhu said the party is consolidating the measures taken to date and would also explore ways to achieve sustained stability in multi-ethnic border areas such as Xinjiang, a western region about 2,400 kilometers or 1,500 miles from Beijing. To Xinjiang's south is Tibet, another region marked by past unrest. We need to think more about how to solve the deep-seated issues, including the social foundation and the soil that give rise to extremism and terrorism, Xu said. China built up an intensive police state in Xinjiang after a series of attacks in the region and elsewhere. A Uyghur drove a car into crowds at Beijing's Tiananmen Square in 2013, and men threw bombs from two SUVs on a busy market street in Urumqi, Xinjiang's capital, killing 43 people in 2014. The threat appears to have receded. The U.S. removed the East Tajikistan Islamic Movement, a Xinjiang group, from its terrorist list in November. Xu did not directly answer whether or not security measures would be relaxed, but said that the United States' move could embolden the group to act. 4 years free of terrorism does not mean there is no threat or danger at all, he said. He repeated the government's vehement denials of forced labor in which vocational training graduates are allegedly pressured to work in factories both in Xinjiang as well as elsewhere in China. Xu said that 117,000 people have gone to work in other parts of China since 2014 through programs that have enabled them to develop skills and leave farms for higher-paying factory work. The U.S. Customs Agency has blocked imports of clothing and other goods from Xinjiang this year over the forced labor issues, and the United Kingdom politicians are demanding that British companies ensure their supply chains are free of forced labor. The United States restrictions have driven some of the region's firms to seek other markets, Xu said, noting there are ample opportunities both at home and abroad. One cannot assume that Xinjiang companies cannot live without the U.S. market or some U.S. companies, he said. Earlier Monday, Xu and other officials held a three-hour news conference in Beijing to refute persistent and mounting international criticism of the government's actions in Xinjiang. Next is an Associated Press story. The dateline is Tokyo, Japan. Virus delays cleanup at Fukushima. Japan's government and the operator of the wrecked Fukushima nuclear plant say that the removal of melted reactor fuel planned to start in 2021 will have to be postponed by about 1 year due to the worsening coronavirus pandemic. The Economy and Industry Ministry and Tokyo Electric Power Company had planned to start removing a first batch of melted debris from the Unit 2 reactor at Fukushima Daiichi sometime next year, marking the 10th anniversary of the disaster triggered by the massive earthquake and tsunami on March 11, 2011. The start of the melted debris removal will now be delayed until late 2022. The worsening virus situation in Britain has caused delays, with a robotic arm being jointly developed in that country by Veolia Nuclear Solutions and Mitsubishi Heavy Industries. Testing has been delayed, and shipment of the robotic arm, initially planned for January, is now expected around April. The overall decommissioning of the nuclear plant is still expected to take 30 to 40 years. And we may not have time for this entire story. Retailers brace for a flood of online returns. A huge surge in online shopping during the pandemic has been a savior for retailers, but it comes at a price. Shoppers are expected to return twice as many items as they did during last year's holiday period, costing companies roughly $1.1 billion, according to Navar Incorporated, a software and technology company that manages online returns for hundreds of brands. Retailers do not want the returns, but they do want shoppers who might not feel safe going to stores to feel comfortable buying things they haven't seen or tried on in person. People have been doing so much online buying since March that carriers such as UPS and Federal Express were already at full capacity before the holiday shopping season, and online sales just keep soaring. From November 1st through Tuesday, they spiked 32% to $171 billion compared with the year-ago period, according to Adobe Analytics. The massive challenges of shipping COVID-19 vaccines in the weeks and months ahead could put further pressure on the system. That means shoppers who return items might not get refunds until 2 weeks after they are sent back to the store, according to Sarah Skirbel, shopping expert at deals site Retail Me Not. Many companies are offering more locations where customers can drop off returns, which cuts down shipping costs and gets refunds to shoppers more quickly. Last year, Kohl's began allowing Amazon returns at all of its 1,000 stores. Customers drop off items for free with no box or label needed. This year, Amazon customers can also return items at 500 Whole Foods market stores. That's in addition to Amazon's deal with UPS to allow similar drop-offs at UPS stores. Happy Returns, a Santa Monica, California-based startup that works with about 150 online retailers like Arathi's and Revolve, has increased its number of drop-off locations to 2,600 from more than 700 last year's. That includes 2,000 FedEx locations. It's a great time to be in the return business. Every day there's a record, said David Sobey, chief executive and co-founder of Happy Returns, noting that he has processed 50% more returns in December than in November. Walmart, the nation's largest retailer, announced earlier this week it will pick up items shipped and sold by Walmart.com from customers' homes for free through a new partnership with FedEx. The service will continue beyond the holiday shopping season. And that brings us to the conclusion of reading the Ames Tribune for this Monday, December 28th, 2020. Thank you for listening to Iris.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate.
Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on EarthDate.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.